Welcome to our third podcast for Another Europe is Possible, aka Left Against Brexit. Today, me and Jamie Coward, filmmaker and member of AEIP, are picking the brains of Stephen Bush from The New Statesman. We pick his brains freely anyway, but nobody normal understands what's happened with the amendments, with the votes this week, what the ramifications are for the Conservative Party, where it leaves Labour. Just about the only thing that's obvious is there weren't as many rebels as anybody thought there would be. I certainly wasn't expecting such a mass Labour walkout after them. So download yourself for us so that we all come away understanding exactly who's where.
I will try my best.
Was I right in thinking the most important amendment was the meaningful vote on the final deal?
Yes, you are. As it stands, the government has guaranteed that there will be a vote, but at the moment, the shape and the wording of that vote is entirely within the government's control. So obviously, if it's Theresa May's deal and no deal, lots of people, including I think some Labour MPs, are probably going to feel that they have to vote for that to avert us tumbling off the cliff edge.
Yeah.
Now, the meaningful vote amendment, had it passed, would mean that it was a genuine meaningful vote, not just one where the government could go, look, here's our deal, vote for it, or the automobile industry gets it. And really everything else can kind of be fixed later. The really important battle over this week and the next couple of weeks is over that meaningful vote.
Right.
Because if the government can get its way on that, then essentially anything else unpopular, they can always fold into the meaningful vote. In the worst case scenario, you can just go, oh, well, that's a bit difficult. I'll just dob it onto here. Because in the end, they've got this pressure valve of a vote where lots of people will not be able to vote it down.
And so the EEA amendment, that was sort of a sideshow.
Yeah, I think the EEA amendment could potentially have been useful in smoking out any Conservatives who were willing to vote for it, perhaps informing some alliances in bits of the PLP that otherwise are slightly at loggerheads. But in terms of actually shaping Brexit, the EEA amendment was pretty pointless because the votes at the present time simply aren't there. There aren't enough Conservative rebels and there are too many Labour MPs who, when push comes to shove, would do as... Weirdly, I expected there to be about 90 rebels.
Right.
I did not expect Labour leavers to contribute 15 of the 19, particularly because as it stood, it was an expressive vote, ultimately. Like, there was no doubt as to which way it was going to go. So 15 Labour MPs felt they needed to vote against it, I think is illustrative of the scale of the task that is ahead of pro-Europeans in terms of persuading enough people to get the numbers to do it later. But it doesn't matter anywhere near as much as the meaningful vote.
So Labour's whipped position was abstention on the EEA.
Yeah.
What's the point of that?
Well, I think the point of having the position as abstention is a couple of things. The first is that although you might say it's crazy talk because close to 100 MPs rebelled, any other position, you'd have even more rebellions if you'd had motion to whip against being in the EEA, and you would have had a smaller number of rebellions overall, but you'd have had more than 15 people breaking the whip to vote against if we'd gone into the EEA. And of course, the Labour leadership does not want to be in the EEA. So the unity position, the thing which gets you the smallest rebellion overall, is to abstain.
We're trying to get Corbyn to either oppose Brexit or massively water it down. Is this just totally a mug's game now?
No, I don't think it is a mug's game, because although obviously Corbyn's views on the EU are well known, I was actually looking back in the weirdness of that first summer. Then at the beginning of the summer, I wasn't allowed to interview him because it was considered below my pay grade, so someone else got to do it. And then at the end of that summer, I wasn't allowed to interview him because it was above my pay grade, so my editor did it. But in both of those interviews, he very openly said then he had many doubts about the European project.
Yeah.
And in that second interview, he said he hadn't closed his mind to Brexit. And that fundamentally hasn't changed. But he doesn't have religion on it. It's not like, say, fracking or Heathrow, issues where he feels incredibly strongly. I mean, if you said to Jeremy you could defeat the government by backing Heathrow, I mean, obviously you couldn't, that would never be true. But if that was true, he wouldn't go, okay, yeah, sure, I will change my view on Heathrow. However, on Brexit, as we've seen with the customs union, if a majority within the House of Commons appears for a softer Brexit, which defeats the government, Jeremy Corbyn will find an excuse. Keir Starmer will be tasked with coming up with an elegant form of words to basically pretend that somehow Labour is not going soft on Brexit in order to facilitate that defeat. I think it is a waste of time, however, to largely target Jeremy himself directly, because his views on the project are not going to change. His views on the parliamentary arithmetic can change if, you know. So I think, you know, the main thing essentially to prove, one, Labour can win with a pro-migration platform, because if you can win with a pro-migration platform, then the free movement stuff stops being politically fraught for a bunch of Labour MPs. Mm-hmm. They can then vote for what they want, which is to keep people in the single market. And at that point, the Labour Party would change its position for the same reason they've changed their position on the customs union. So no, I don't think it is a waste of time. I think in an odd way, the biggest problem with Jeremy Corbyn's Euroscepticism from the perspective of someone who wants to keep us in the single market or to stop Brexit entirely is we spend an awful lot of time talking about Jeremy Corbyn's views about the EU, which would matter if Labour won the next election with, say, 380 MPs and they had a huge majority of 100 and he could do whatever it is he wanted.
Yeah.
It would matter a bit. No, actually, I can't really think of another situation in which it would matter.
Does it really not matter what their position is? Because there's no election coming up. The vast majority of people aren't really thinking about this anyway.
I think it does matter, because they sort of know that they can't go into a general election with a position as it is now.
It's not this fudge, no.
And until they've got a position, they can't really force the hand of the government. They're pretending to want to bring the government down, but at the moment, they don't really want the government to fall. So I think the minute they have a solid position, they'll suddenly have a lot more dynamism in the way they operate politically. But obviously, I want it to be the right position before that happens. How did you think this was going to shake down?
Well, my assumption was that about maybe 75 to 80 Labour MPs would break the whip to vote to keep us in the EEA.
Right.
They might be joined by three or four Conservatives. In the end, there were only three. And the remainder would be made up by Labour MPs who wanted to stay in the EEA. In the end, there were slightly fewer Labour Remainers who voted to keep us in the EEA, and there were slightly more Labour Leavers in the end.
And what is your sense of those Remainers who would typically... Because it was a big Labour push by some of Labour, by, let's call it for fun, the right of Labour, to get that EEA amendment and to make that front and centre. Why didn't it pan out the way they thought it would?
I think the problem is it's because the right of the Labour Party is also split on the issue. You have a group of pro-Europeans who want to stay in and basically regard that as the most important thing. You have a group of pro-Europeans who want to stay in but have this lunatic idea that you can somehow have some kind of opt-out or emergency brake on free movement. And obviously those two groups don't agree, because the first group goes, well, this is nonsense. Of course, the problem is, while they're having that argument, another group of people on the right of the Labour Party who believe that the vote to leave was primarily about the free movement of labour, and that you cannot get away with a Brexit deal in which that is not ended, just thinking the EEA is not remotely doable. What went wrong was that a lot of the pro-Europeans basically thought that they would at least be able to get the support of all of the pro-Europeans.
Yeah.
But not unreasonably, I was talking to someone on the front bench about why they were not going to resign, and their take was, well, if I thought I could resign, rebel, and win, I would do it tomorrow, but I'm not going to resign, rebel, and lose, because what would be the point? And so in an odd way, the various pro-European groupings, both within and without the Labour Party, have got a bit of a problem in the... They all have a brilliant individual argument for doing nothing, right? So the argument for why should I quit the front bench when we're going to lose this vote is very strong.
Yeah. It's very strong.
The argument for I've already criticised Jeremy on five issues, so why should I rebel on this vote when we're not going to win it is strong.
Very strong.
And the argument for I'm a Conservative and I'm worried I'll be deselected by my pro-Leave constituents and the Labour Party isn't going to deliver the votes, so why should I rebel is strong.
Mm.
But of course, unless one of those groups makes a decisive move, unless the right of the Labour Party can deliver 100 rebels and unless the Conservative Party can deliver 15 rebels, up until that point, it's in no one's interest to go, OK, I'm going to take this risk. And that's part of why the rebellion was, well, I mean, obviously it was large in absolute terms, but in terms of what we know about the number of Labour MPs who want to be in the EEA, it was quite small.
Big was it in absolute terms?
So in absolute terms, it's 90. There are now 260-odd Labour MPs, so it's around about a third. But equally, if I were to pick up the phone and survey every Labour Party MP, I would expect about 190 of them to say they want to be in the EEA. So mostly when MPs rebel on something they feel strongly about, you wouldn't expect more than half of them to go, actually, I'm going to abstain on this. So it was both very large and a very small rebellion in terms of where majority opinion in the Parliamentary Labour Party is.
What's stopping them just forgetting the EEA for the time being and lining up behind Keir and the meaningful vote amendment?
Well, because the other sort of part of the battle is about what Labour's ultimate position in their next manifesto on the EU is, right? So the reason for this internal market, which has a lot of influences from the IPPR's shared market platform, bluntly, it is a device to allow people who want to vote for the EEA but don't want to vote against the Labour leadership to vote for that and go, okay, well, I've bridged these two things. Unfortunately, the shared market is to the left of the Labour Party what staying in the EEA without free movement is to the right of the Labour Party. Yeah. It just doesn't exist. It's not a meaningful endpoint. So in some ways, the real battle is over which one of two realistic aims, the EEA plus the customs union or a very distant relationship from the EU, end up as Labour's final position. I do also think the other part of it is its displacement activity, right? If you don't agree with the present leadership of the Labour Party, you don't like the present Conservative Party, so you can't really go anywhere else, and you're angry about Brexit, in an odd way, some pro-European Labour MPs have become like UKIP voters. They feel the world has changed, they're really angry about it, and they just want to vote for what they see as things which will make it better.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, the EEA amendment is like that. They know when you go, but look, give me a list of 325 MPs who are going to vote for this. They kind of go, I don't have that.
Yeah.
But they just think it's a terrible idea to leave the single market, and they just want to register that in some way, shape or form. So it's an emotional rather than a political strategy for a lot of the EEA rebels.
So Theresa May, was she expecting the Dominic Grieve move, do you think?
No, they weren't expecting that Dominic Grieve amendment late on. They knew they had a problem with the amendment as it stood. When they were defeated on the meaningful vote the first time around,
yeah,
when they had to guarantee that there would be one, but they didn't have to give any guarantees on its shape, the government waited very late to compromise with the rebels. They basically went, well, we'll trade it in for what's in the box.
Mm-hmm.
And the rebels went, well, you're not showing us what's in the box, so no, we think we're fine, Kay, thanks. And that's why they were defeated the first time on the meaningful vote. This time, the government went, okay, we're going to get out really early with our compromise. The problem is their first compromise was rubbish, and they gave people 48 hours to look at it. And the thing that's really important is that most MPs, we forget this because obviously MPs who do rebel get all of the headlines. An MP who used to rebel an awful lot is now leader of the Labour Party, and a bunch of MPs who used to rebel an awful lot are now in key positions implementing Brexit. But the average MP will find any excuse not to make life difficult for their own party.
Yeah.
And so I think if the Conservative government had gone a bit later, but with the amendment they put forward, then I think a lot more people would have gone, okay, fine, fair enough, I've got my excuse not to make trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they went very early. Grieve went, well, this is inadequate for X, Y, and Z reasons. Oh, I'm going to bring an amendment that does what this compromise claims to do, but actually codifies it. Dominic Grieve, despite the fact he doesn't get written up by the press very much, is hugely influential among Conservative pro-Europeans because he's been a pro-European for a long time. He is an eminent lawyer. So, yeah, the thing you've got to remember is obviously most MPs aren't lawyers. So when the government says, we've made a concession A lot of them are like, oh, well, that seems legit.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's hugely influential because obviously what most pro-European Conservatives do when they're presented with that is they go, okay, great. And they pick up their mobiles. They call Dominic Grieve and they go, Dominic, what does this concession mean?
Yeah.
So the government weren't expecting him to come out and go, look, here's my thing. It's safe to vote for. You can trust me because, you know, I'm also a pro-European. This will fly. The government basically went, okay, look, don't defeat us because that's embarrassing, but we will introduce basically that I can't believe it's not the Grieve amendment in the House of Lords next week. Because these Lords amendments have been defeated, basically goes back to the House of Lords, and then the Lords can either accept the defeat or they can try and amend it again. Now, as we speak, there is some very frenzied negotiation going on between Conservative rebels and Downing Street. Downing Street is saying, actually, we said we would bring something a bit like the Grieve amendment, but not really. And they're saying, no, you did say you would bring the Grieve amendment. Regardless of whether or not the government does a deal with the Conservative rebels at this stage, they will have to go through this again next week, because it is an absolute certainty that there will be some Lords amendment that will basically be identical to the one Dominic Grieve put through. Mm-hmm. The only question is whether or not Theresa May decides to go, okay, I'm going to be the author of this, or I'm going to be the victim of it. And that will also depend on whether or not she thinks she is better off saying, here's my compromise, or better off being able to turn to her right flank and go, well, guys, what can I do?
None of us know the Greaves Amendment until it comes back from the Lords. Is that correct?
Yeah, so none of us will know what the compromise amendment looks like. At the moment, it's essentially, and I'm going to paraphrase, it's basically, in the event of the government not having reached any deal by November, Parliament can effectively automatically step in. In the event of the meaningful vote, the structure has to be like this. It cannot be our way or the highway. And in the event of Parliament not liking the deal, it has the following powers after it has voted it down.
Mm-mm.
Now, the government is basically saying, well, we're fine with the time limit. We're not fine with Parliament having additional power. Basically, they still want to be able to have a situation in which they can go, it's the deal, it's the cliff.
Mm-mm.
I cannot see. I mean, even though Conservative rebels have only rebelled once in sufficient numbers to defeat the government, this is the issue on which they've rebelled. I think then they were right to do so the first time, because the second you don't rebel on the meaningful vote, you've lost all of your leverage as a Conservative Remainer. And although Conservative Remainers have done a number of tactically inept things, not least holding the referendum in the first place, I simply cannot believe that anyone is so tactically inept and they would allow the meaningful vote as it stands to be presented to them. Partly because if you're a Conservative Remainer and Theresa May keels over tomorrow, you've ceded control of the negotiations to an executive which will be run by whichever lever manages to emerge out of that process.
What would your advice be to lefty Remainers like us, just from a campaigning point of view?
I think, yeah, ages ago when I interviewed Diane Abbott, she slightly, only half ironically, said the problem was there were no more proper neoliberals on the right of the Labour Party. She said, when she was talking about she ran for leader, she said David Miliband was always freedom of capital, free movement.
Yeah.
So by the time Jeremy Corbyn was running, it was just freedom of capital, but maybe free movement is the problem. To build alliances on pro-migration across the party and then to convince and explain how it is that you can win and convince people on immigration, right? Because that is the sort of central issue. If Labour cannot win the argument for why the free movement of people is great, which, I mean, to be honest, ought to be easy, not least, I find it slightly embarrassing that a party called the Labour Party is now literally at the moment its unity position is that Labour should have fewer movement rights than capital. I mean, it's just like, what is that about?
Yeah, but yeah.
Basically, the main thing is proving that that argument can be made, that you can win people over, then there are things that you can say, you know, in terms of, you know, the Gillian Duffy, Gordon Brown, basically to say, look, here are the things that if you're a Labour MP, you ought to say when someone goes, who are these people flocking over?
Mm. Yeah,
that
yeah.
isn't going to result in you being turfed out and you going the way of your mates in the Scottish Labour Party, which is the fear that haunts a lot of Labour MPs. Now, I don't think that would happen. But basically, until that fear is eradicated from the minds of Labour MPs, there is no path to a better or no Brexit.
When Jeremy Corbyn came in, he campaigned on the understanding that, first of all, he would reject the racialisation of, and secondly, that he would give the members say in party policy.
Yeah.
Given that both of those two things he seems to be sort of ignoring now, how conflicted do you think you might feel personally about that?
Well, I think the thing is on the sort of migration perspective, the weird thing is what Jeremy's essentially done is invert the old electoral bargain than Blair had, which was we'll have free movement within Europe, but don't worry, we'll make up for it by being really horrible to everyone who wants to come here from outside of Europe. If you look at the Labour 2017 manifesto and the things Diane Abbott is saying about migration and refugees, that stuff's all great.
Mm.
They're basically going, we'll be really compassionate to anyone who wants to come here or people who need to come here, but we won't have the free movement of labour. So I actually think, not unreasonably, Jeremy himself and people in the leader's office will go, actually, we've got quite a radical migration policy across the piece. And they don't particularly see the right to free movement within Europe as anywhere near as important as the ways they have moved, you know, kind of in some ways, his weirdness that he, on the one hand, has a migration policy which is well to the left of what came before, and on the other hand, one which is well to the right. So it probably averages out as not having moved at all. But I think, from their perspective, not unreasonably, right, the treatment of refugees and people who are fleeing here is a much more important hill to die on than the rights of free movement. So on that one, he's fine. I think, to be honest, in terms of giving members more say, the joy of covering the Labour Party is eventually every available faction holds every available position on giving the members votes. And in the end, people find it a lot easier when they feel that their issues are right. And no one has any guilt about going, okay, well, now I'm in charge, I'm going to impose my will.
Yeah.
Candidly, I actually think that although I don't like where Jeremy has ended up on the European issue, he is the party's prime minister designate, and I'm quite relaxed about him having broad powers. I think it's a bit of a shame in a way than pro-Europeans on the right of the Labour Party, who used to argue for the right of MPs to make these decisions, and actually I think they have a point, turning around and suddenly going, oh no, we need to have a member's vote. Not least because, yeah, one of the things which is paralysing politics at the moment is, yes, the referendum was lost, and I think in order to reverse Brexit, you have to find out how you can reverse the referendum with another referendum. But no number of votes can make us leaving the European project the best way to combat climate change or not being in the single market the way to have a referendum. And I just think we shouldn't pretend that a member's vote would change how any of us thought about the European issue.
I mean, I feel very kind of sceptical about that, because the fact is, A, Jeremy Corbyn is meant to be a kind of very democratic movement, but I think he's making a Blair calculation. Just as Blair said, well, we've got all those votes and they're in the bag, let's go for these votes. He knows that even though so many Labour constituencies are in Leave areas, there are only 20 constituencies in the country where the Remain vote of Labour voters isn't a lot higher than the Leave vote. So he knows he's got a Remain party. And it feels to me very imperious and 90s to bank all those Remainers as yours anyway and go after the people who you don't agree with. It just doesn't seem at all commensurate with what his kind of Saint Jeremy aspect is.
I mean, it is in some ways classic triangulation, but equally the thing is he doesn't really like the EU. So it's not sort of pure triangulation in a sense.
Keep but, reminding yourself.
But he does also know that. Because for most pro-Europeans, right, there are things about the EU as it currently exists that we like. There are things we would very much like to change. But actually, it's the idea of Europe that appeals to them. And in terms of the things which appeal to people about the idea of Europe, the calculation that I think he rightly makes from an electoral perspective is that his brand and everything else he does appeals enough to those voters that he can moving across to win voters where his brand does not appeal. Whether or not it's 90s or whether or not it's effective, of course, is, I guess, the big question we'll find out at the next election. My objection to it, and indeed my objection to Labour's sort of wider discount about, oh, we've got a problem in small towns and all this, is your answer to whether or not we think it's important to be in the single market, important to be in the European project in terms of our policy aims, can't be there are some people in Cheadle who don't like the Labour Party. That's just not a way that you can form macroeconomic policy. You have to work out what it is you want to do and then win consent for it afterwards.
Watching the Conservative negotiations, not so much their own kind of rebellions or mini-rebellions or kind of climb downs, but actually the negotiations and the way that they tried to reach consensus in order to go to Europe and negotiate, I kind of feel like Brexit can't happen, opposed or not opposed, because they can't even reach a consensus on the customs union 2 years in.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth in that, in that it feels, and weirdly, not only can they not reach consensus, but they're actually making each other less reality-based. So with the customs union, right, they started with effectively the position of, we can just get away with having a hard border. We said there wouldn't be one in the referendum. We can get away with it. What's one more broken promise now? And then we'll have the freedom to strike our own proper trade deals, which I'm not necessarily certain they could get away with one more broken promise. But that is, from a policy perspective, that is an achievable thing they might have been able to get. Mm-hmm. And then you had on the other side a group of Conservative MPs going, no, we can't have border infrastructure. It will threaten this really great achievement. It will derail the peace process. We have to stay in the customs union. Those are two real-world positions. Mm. And now we have a situation in which Conservative Remainers are going, maybe we'll have this magical thing called a customs arrangement where we magically collect tariff goods, but we're kind of both in and not in the customs union. And then the Leavers have gone, no, that's not a real-world position. Mm. True. Our new position is that blockchain will solve the Irish border. And they now have a working group looking into both of these ones to reach a consensus one, despite the fact they've actually both moved away from a real-world prospect.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. It is hard, I think, to work out what deal they are going to strike that unites all of the Conservative Party. Now, maybe they can, through the threat of the cliff, convince enough people to stay on, but I don't see how they're going to still have the threat of the cliff when it comes round. And so I do think that the chances of a very bare bones withdrawal agreement and an indefinite transition are really high, because that is the only thing they can all agree on is, well, maybe we'll wait and eventually we will somehow come to a consensus. And one of the fascinating things about working in Parliament is watching how MPs do convince themselves of things which just aren't true. Before the 2016 Labour leadership election, I remember I got married a couple of weeks after it was over. I went on honeymoon and a bunch of Corbyn sceptic MPs had convinced themselves of this idea. He only got 49.95% of the members in the first one. They had convinced themselves entirely seriously that this meant that if you imagine there were no two-pounders, that the remaining 55.05, none of those would have second preferenced him, right? They had somehow convinced themselves that this was true, even though obviously that's nonsense, because we've all met people who voted Yvette Cooper 1, Corbyn 2, Andy Burnham 1, Corbyn 2, even Liz Kendall 1, Corbyn 2. But they just convinced themselves it was true. And at least all that led to was a doomed attempt to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, right? No one's economic hopes were damaged as a result of that campaign. But within the Conservative Party, they similarly have just convinced themselves of a bunch of things which aren't true, which they did not believe, even the leavers did not believe at the start of this process. And unfortunately, there is a possibility that a lot of people's economic hopes will be harmed by this weirdness, unless, of course, it doesn't happen.
It is kind of terrifying still, though, isn't it? That I don't know whether this feels different when you're a bit closer to Parliament, but I've never felt that they were quite so fanciful.
Oh, no, I think definitely, even in the beginning of the May era, and you would talk to a Conservative MP about, oh, what, how do you feel about this bit of legislation? What are your plans for this? How do you think you're going to stay in office? They would often say things I viscerally disagreed with, but they would never say anything that I knew to be wrong.
Only things
that I thought to be wrong. And now, every day, a Conservative MP will say something to me, and I say, no, I know that you've just declared that water flows uphill. Or that, the problem with the EU negotiations is actually that the EU is being difficult about something which the UK government had committed to before the EU even asked it to. Mm-hmm. And yet they are getting more weird. There's another sort of terrifying subplot in all of this, which is, of course, Conservative MPs have a significantly looser selection process than Labour ones. Their membership is getting smaller and smaller and more into leaving the European Union, and similarly more and more reality detached. I mean, there is the horrific possibility that we have a transition deal, and then the question every Conservative candidate, either for a seat that is currently occupied and a vacant one, the first question they're asked is, when are you going to pull us out of this terrible transition?
They are just
getting crazier at a rate of knots.
Somebody on Twitter said Barnier knew that the Irish border problem was irresolvable and so was determined to play hardball from now until eternity. Do you think that's true? Because I'd always thought the Irish border was irresolvable because we had stupid people trying to resolve it. But do you think it is actually irresolvable?
No, it's irresolvable because of the various red lines of the Conservative Party.
Right.
You can either have a border in the Irish Sea and Northern Ireland doesn't leave the single market and the customs union. Well, the Tories and the DUP have ruled that out. You can have the whole of the United Kingdom stays within the customs union and the single market.
Yeah.
You can have the whole of the United Kingdom stays within very close regulatory and customs alignment. Or you can have a hard border on the island of Ireland. What you cannot have is this weird thing the Conservatives want to have where they don't want a border in the Irish Sea, don't want a hard border on the island of Ireland, don't want close regulatory alignment. It is true that basically since the election, the feeling in the EU is that the government is sufficiently weak that instead of trying to persuade them to pick, so one of the preferred options, right, are you end up with regulatory alignment but not much trade, mm-hmm. or you end up with the UK and something like the EEA and the customs union. Now, obviously, from solving the Irish border perspective, either of those two work. However, it's not in the EU's interests for us not to be in some kind of weird adjunct of them. And they do now believe that because of Theresa May's weakness, they can achieve that. But no, the essential problem, and I say this as someone who cannot imagine a situation where I would vote leave, the trade-off of, you know, how much freedom do you have and how much economic prosperity and the ability to work together on joint projects you have, right, is a real one. It is actually a worthwhile discussion to have. But unsurprisingly, I suppose, considering everything that powers the right of politics, they refuse to acknowledge the idea that the freedom of poverty is a very limited freedom, which means they refuse to accept that there are these trade-offs, is why we end up in a situation where the Irish border becomes unsolvable.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you, Jamie Coward.
Anytime.
Goodbye from me, Zoe Williams. Cheerio.